You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get a preview of Wisconsin's 40th annual celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and legacy. The event is Monday at the state capitol. Right now, it's time for a weekly Wisconsin News Roundup, checking in with reporters around the state about the stories they're covering. First, the Eau Claire City Council unanimously passed a new ordinance that will require homeowners to replace lead service lines on their property if they're discovered during utility work. Rich Kramer is a WPR News reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how does this work? What changes under this new ordinance?
Well, really what changes is that what was a voluntary program, but also was highly encouraged by the city, and which also already has included grant money to help homeowners with the costs, but it's now mandatory. Basically, now there's a threat of fines, I guess, but the city said that they're not going into this to try to punish anybody, but they just want to make sure that they replace around 830 lead service lines that exist in communities or in neighborhoods of Eau Claire. So these are the water lines that go from the water main under the street that goes to the property line, and from the property line to the house, that's the homeowner's responsibility, and from the water main to this curb, basically, is the city's responsibility. So on the homeowner side, about 830 lines need to be replaced. Homeowners, once these things are found by the city notifies the homeowner. They have 90 days to replace them or get some sort of contract in place with a contractor who will do the work. If not, they're subject to potentially fines between $60 and $500 per day. But again, the city stressed big time at the meeting that that's not what they're out to do. They're not trying to punish anybody. They just want to help get these things out of there.
A lot of communities are wrestling with the health impacts of these lead pipes. As I understand it, Rich, and I think this may have come up in your reporting, part of the problem is that if you just replace the city's part up to the home part and not the lead that runs the rest of the way into the house, that could actually, at least at first, make things even worse?
Yeah, much worse. So the way it was described to me by Eau Claire's basically public works director, Jeff Pippinger, is that they add things into the water to kind of keep the lead from seeping into the water, basically hydrated lime. And what that does is it lowers the or it raises the pH so that the water's not as acidic and not as likely to eat away at the lead and dissolve it, for lack of better terms. But the lime also creates kind of a white powdery coating that keeps the lead from making contact with the water. So when they do disrupt things on the city side, Pippinger said it's highly likely, and it's been shown in many studies, that coating will chip off, and then you'll have dangerous levels of lead potentially going into the home. And that's bad for anyone, but particularly small children and pregnant women.
And you mentioned this grant program going to help these residents replace those pipes. Are other cities around the state looking to get in on similar kinds of programs with their lead service lines?
Oh, absolutely. So the Department of Natural Resources has a safe drinking water program, and it's a revolving loan fund, but grants, for lack of better terms. They, some of the cities that have implemented ordinances like Eau Claire include Madison, Milwaukee, Kewaunee, Clintonville, Kenosha, Menasha, and Manitowoc. But more than that, a lot of other communities besides those have applied for this grant funding to help. Eau Claire has gotten, since 2017, about $800,000 in grant funds, and that has led to, the city said they spent about half of that, have replaced about 153 lead service lines, so they're hoping to get another $400,000 to do 200 more yet in the near future.
Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, with us to talk about a new rule in Eau Claire requiring residents to replace lead service lines. Now, the Wisconsin Public Service Commission signed off this week on construction of a $700 million natural gas generator in Superior, despite some concerns from environmental groups. Chris Hubbeck reports on energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. Chris, welcome back.
Hi, happy to be here.
Well, describe for us the scope of this project and its potential energy impact.
Well, this is about a 625 megawatt, what's called a combined cycle natural gas plant, which means it It's a more efficient plant that captures a little bit more of the heat from the natural gas. It's kind of a unique ownership model in that it would be jointly owned by Dairyland Power Cooperative, which is a rural electric generation cooperative based in La Crosse, and then a subsidiary of Minnesota Power, which is a Duluth-based investor-owned utility, and that it would serve as essentially a merchant plant selling power into the market.
It got the thumbs up from the state's Public Service Commission, but there have been concerns from environmental groups. What are some of the worries that those groups have raised?
I think the number one concern for most of the groups is simply the greenhouse gas emissions. Estimates are it would be about 2.5 million tons of carbon dioxide a year. And this is a plant with an expected life of 30 years or more. So that would be running well into the time when, when carbon emissions really need to get to zero to avoid some pretty catastrophic rise in global temperatures. There are secondary concerns about just whether the aquifer there can support it. Some of the models showed that it would deplete the groundwater because it does require quite a bit of water. There are other concerns about erosion, runoff, loss of wetlands.
And in our last few moments, Chris, I got the thumbs up from the Public Service Commission. What other regulatory steps are left?
Well, it's got about half a dozen permits that will be required from the DNR for everything from air emissions to water use. It's also facing some hurdles back in Minnesota where it was approved. Minnesota Power's investment was approved last year, but just late last year, an appeals court ruled that the regulators there did need to consider some of the environmental impacts, which they had not done. And so that will have to get another review in Minnesota.
We'll keep watching out for that. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Chris Hubbuck is an energy and environmental reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. He talked with us about a major natural gas plant in Superior getting cleared for construction by the state's Public Service Commission. Now, federal agents and Milwaukee law enforcement led two major drug busts this week, arresting more than two dozen people in the city and in Puerto Rico. John Diedrich is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you reported on two big drug busts in Milwaukee this week. Let's focus on Operation Island Hopper. More than 20 people arrested, most in Milwaukee, some in Puerto Rico. What do we know about how this drug operation worked?
Well, it's interesting. So this is an operation that brought in cocaine into Milwaukee. The origins of the cocaine go to Central and South America. Colombia drug operation was supplying cocaine, which ultimately went through the Dominican Republic into Puerto Rico and into Milwaukee. The really interesting aspect of this case is that it entered into the U.S. mail system in Puerto Rico. And so individuals in Puerto Rico were mailing cocaine, large, like six and a half pounds of cocaine at a time, in the U.S. postal system from Puerto Rico to Milwaukee. And again, to remind folks, Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, so they have the post office there.
How did authorities first figure out this was going on?
You know, it's not clear. It's 2018 when the first parcel was detected. They didn't specifically talk about detection ways. I know from earlier reporting that they're looking for things like suspicious addresses or packaging that might have the hallmarks like overtaped, things of that nature that sometimes signify a questionable parcel. They also have informants in the case. So that's a possibility that it was a combination of a suspicious-looking package and also informants that pointed them to this Puerto Rico to Milwaukee connection.
So talk about the arrests now. What do we know about that?
Well, so this week they had a takedown involving 300 officers that spread out across the city. There's 26 defendants in this case. As you mentioned, there was another case as well, coincidentally unrelated to this, but that there was a roundup that day as well. But in this case, in Operation Island Hopper, there were 26 defendants, most of them in Milwaukee. They spread out simultaneously early on Wednesday morning, as they do, and arrested everyone. And they started making appearances in federal court here in Milwaukee this week. There are four people who are still being sought, both in Milwaukee and Puerto Rico. Charges are very significant. We're talking about 10-year minimums if people are convicted, up to life in prison. And that's because of the amount of the drugs that were coming through. The U.S. Attorney, Matt Krieger, here for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, calls it incredible volumes of drugs. You can see from the criminal complaint, which is 230 pages long, just a documentation about packages coming constantly from Puerto Rico into Milwaukee, and then the cash being sent also through the mail from Milwaukee back to Puerto Rico, and ultimately probably down to Colombia, where the drugs were purchased in the first place.
Is there a thought or any indication that, okay, if they're mailing cocaine from Puerto Rico to Milwaukee, this might be an operation that would also send cocaine to other cities as well?
Well, that's right. There is there's indications in the criminal complaint that cocaine was also forwarded on to East Coast cities, to cities along the southwest border between the United States and Mexico. So in that way, Milwaukee became a, you know, sort of hub of cocaine distribution out, which is what you wouldn't think of that. You think more of like Miami or Houston or whatever being closer to the border. But because of the mail connection, Milwaukee actually became a hub of distributing cocaine to other places. And, you know, it's how this all stood up. It's not exactly clear how these individuals came to Milwaukee. There is a significant Puerto Rican population here. Most of them, you know, law abiding. At some point, though, somebody recognized the ability to get into the mail system, and that was the key. Now, the message that the U.S. Attorney has sent out, as he said, this case shows that we're going to be tough on this and detect contraband coming through the mail. I can tell you from experience, having covered federal courts for a while, most often what you see are cases involving marijuana, because that has smell to it. Things like cocaine, heroin, and others don't have smell to it. And so, and because there's so many parcels of mail that go through the U.S. mail system, there is this challenge that authorities have to find out. And again, the U.S. attorney talked about the incredible amount of cocaine that was coming in, and the more than $1 million, at least $1 million in proceeds that went back to Puerto Rico and ultimately into South America through this operation.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
John Diedrich is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked with us about a major drug bust on Wednesday that resulted in more than 20 arrests. He helped us finish out our Wisconsin News Roundup. Monday is the federal Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. At noon in the Wisconsin State Capitol, the 40th annual tribute and ceremony will take place. Our own Jonathan Overby is the host and executive director of the Road to Higher Ground. With Jonathan Overby, heard Saturdays from 7 to 11 p.m. on WPR's NPR News and Classical Music Network. He's been involved since that first MLK Jr. Day celebration in 1980 and joins us to talk about the last four decades and this year's celebration. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is the 40th anniversary, I understand, of the tribute and ceremony on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It's the oldest official state celebration in the country. How did it get started?
Well, like many things that have a long shelf life, it started with a bit of chaos. And I recall back in 1980, a handful of folks from various segments of Madison, Milwaukee, and some other areas around the state got together and said, let's do a tribute to Dr. King. And it was such a kerfuffle with so many agencies being involved. People were worn out by the time the event was over. And they said, we're not going to do it again. We just, you know, let something else happen. And I had participated in the very first one. I sang and decided this can't be shelved. We actually need to continue celebrating the life and legacy of Dr. King. And so from 1980, actually for me producing it, 1981, until this coming Monday, I produced all of the events in celebration of Dr. King's birthday and what he lived and died for.
How has this event changed and I guess grown over the years?
It's evolved to balance the participation from different communities from across the state. And it's not a Madison event. It is truly a statewide event. And one of the things that I'm most pleased about is that the Capitol Rotunda on that day is filled with people from different walks of life. It's very rare to see that happen at the Capitol, that you have people from the religious community, from campuses across the state, people in leadership from state government to the university system and beyond. And it's a lot of work that goes into producing it, but on the day of, it seems to all come together as people realize the importance of what Dr. King asked us to do and what he asked us to live for.
The theme this year is Stand for Justice. Can you talk about how that connects with Reverend King's legacy?
Well, it's right down Main Street for him. Justice was what he championed, and this event, like all of the other events, champions and did champion over the years justice for all people. But this year has, at least for me personally, a little different timbre. Maybe it's even more than just a little. It's quite profound that today there seems to be, in my view, a spirit of hostility toward those who are different, people who are immigrants, people whose lives are on the margins of life, people who are poor, people who don't fit into the mainstream ideas of what some think America should look like and represent. And so I'm committed to make this event to, as best I can, to represent a spirit of hospitality for all Wisconsinites, all people, no matter where they hail from, that this day we set aside our differences and celebrate one of the things that's really core to America, and that is this hospitality, being welcoming and civil toward each other.
A lot of people will have experienced past events listening here on Wisconsin Public Radio. A lot of people will do that on Monday as well. For those of us who haven't made it or can't make it, can you set the stage for us? What's it like to be there in person?
Well, you ask a very profound question. It's very, you know, it's you've stumped me a bit because I'm so engaged in making sure that the event drives itself as planned. But in those moments where I can step back and appreciate what's happening, it becomes a gathering of people whose minds are set to be on one accord, people who gather to actually make a statement without any pretense, but to actually say, I want to do my part to be more cordial to my neighbor, to live in the spirit of Dr. King's legacy, to show love and appreciation and welcoming to the stranger, the person who's different, the person who's in some circles is perceived to be a threat by way of what they wear, how they look, the language that they talk, or the food that they eat. And so for me, I'm committed to keeping that narrative before those who attend and listen, that this is an important event that by design is focused on drawing us together as a nation, as a state, and as a collective of people who have commonalities but some very unique differences. And I think that is really American. And to embrace each other differently is, in my view, very un-American.
As you mentioned, you sang at the founding event back in 1980, and music has stayed a central part of it since then. Can you talk about how important music is and has been for this annual event?
Well, my mother would have it no other way when she lived. And Dr. King loved music. His wife, Coretta Scott King, was a singer. And music was, in many ways, the underpinning to the civil rights movement. The songs that people sang helped them to struggle through, to keep hope and to sustain them during some really turbulent episodes during the civil rights movement, leading up to it and after. And so some believe that music is the international language that everybody can embrace at some level. I think it has a redeeming social quality to it and that it can, in fact, create understanding between different groups and also bring some social healing that I think we desperately need in this country.
Can you give us a taste of the kind of performers and speakers we'll be hearing from on Monday?
Well, I'm not going to sing.
You're right not?
Now. Well, not now, but I may, okay. I may on the day of. I should tell you that the idea is to make gospel music a cornerstone to the event. And that is because the African-American church was vital to the success of the civil rights movement. And in particular, I need to say that women were vital to the civil rights movement and by and large have not been given the recognition that they so that they deserved. And so this event, like many of the others in recent memory, have had, and this one will, a womanist texture to it. So from the stage manager to the music director to those who are working the event to the conductors to the people who are singing solos to the people behind the scenes, they're all vital to this event, primarily because without waving a flag about it, in my view, it's the way it should be.
As we wrap up, remind us the time, the basics for people who want to go or to listen.
Well, it starts at noon, and you can hear it on Wisconsin Public Radio. And get there early if you can to get a seat for Monday, the 20th of January. And my goal is to have you leave with a heightened sense of celebration for who we are as a nation and, of course, who we are as Wisconsinites. So that's the goal. And we've got a speaker, Dr. Ollie Watts Davis, who hails from Illinois, and some special surprise guests who are going to render music as well. So I'm really delighted to be able to be a part of it. And I have to say, I don't do this alone. There are nearly 50 people who helped to put this on, and without their help, it has never been and will not be the kind of success that we all hope it will be.
Thanks for joining us and for your work and the work of the whole team.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's our own Jonathan Overby. You can hear him on the MLK Day celebration this Monday. WPR will air the broadcast live on both the Ideas Network and the News and Classical Network. PBS Wisconsin will also air the tribute live at noon on the Wisconsin Channel and live stream it on pbswisconsin.org. Jonathan Overby is host and executive producer as well of The Road to Higher Ground. You can hear him Saturdays from 7 to 11 p.m. on WPR's NPR News and Classical Music Network. The issue of age discrimination is getting a lot of attention right now. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week on a case about age discrimination in the federal workforce and on Capitol Hill. A bipartisan bill that would make it easier for older workers to bring an age discrimination case just passed the U.S. House of Representatives. Lisa Lampkins is the advocacy director at AARP Wisconsin and has been monitoring that legislation. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
What kind of changes, Lisa, would this legislation make if it becomes law?
Well, you know, we are, first of all, really pleased to see the, we call it Protecting Older Workers Against Discrimination Act, to see that it passed the House of Representatives on such a bipartisan basis. It's really time to fight some of this age bias. And what it would really do is give older workers the same fairness under the law as any other worker. There was a court case in 2009 that made it a lot harder to show that you were discriminated against based on age. And what this legislation would do would really level the playing field. It's not really even a new protection for people. It's just saying, hey, let's apply the same burden of proof, the same standard to age discrimination as we do to discrimination based on sex or race or religion or whatever. We were thrilled that this bill passed. And I just have to add that one of the lead sponsors and champion of the bill was none other than Wisconsin's own Jim Sensenbrenner from the 5th Congressional District. He really was a leader in making this happen.
You mentioned that 2009 Supreme Court case. Check me on this and make sure I have this right. It's kind of a subtle difference. That case said that whereas most kinds of discrimination, if you can prove that that discrimination was a factor in, say, your firing or not being hired, that met the burden of proof. Now, for age discrimination at that after that case, you had to prove that age discrimination was the factor, the only factor in your firing. Do I have that right?
You absolutely do. That's an excellent way to describe it. And you can see how it would be much harder to prove that age discrimination was the one and only reason as opposed to just one reason. That really put the burden of proof on the employee, on the plaintiff, and made it really hard. And as a result, you know, we've seen fewer and fewer people even make formal complaints around age discrimination. So it would be a giant step forward in leveling the playing field and making sure that older workers have protections if we can get this new piece of legislation across the finish line.
That Supreme Court case, as we said, was 2009. We just flipped our calendars to 2020. Why did it take so long for Congress to react to the Supreme Court ruling?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. I think one of the reasons is there was a sense among elected officials that this was some kind of new protection and that it was going to be difficult for businesses. But the fact of the matter is, it's really just taking age discrimination and providing the protections that have been in place for decades. And then in 2009, it got flipped. We've been working on it since 2009. We've been trying to get that case overturned and get legislation to sort of clarify that discriminating for any reason, including age, it's just wrong. And so, you know, it was a good first step. Now we've got to get it through the Senate and to the president, and AARP and many others are going to keep sort of fighting to make sure that happens.
Talking to Lisa Lamkins, Advocacy Director at AARP Wisconsin, looking at legislation. It's passed the U.S. House that would turn back the clock in a way on age discrimination laws, in effect changing things from a 2009 Supreme Court ruling that made it harder to establish age discrimination in lawsuits. Lisa, let's talk about the issue of age discrimination. How common is it as you see it?
Well, you know, unfortunately, age discrimination seems to be the last accepted bias. It occurs every day across this country. We've done studies that show 3 in 5 older workers have seen or experienced age discrimination in the workplace, and nearly 1 in 4 older workers are subjected to negative comments about their age from their supervisor or their coworkers. So we know age discrimination has been tolerated, or sometimes even worse, that it really hasn't even been recognized that there is age discrimination when people make offhand comments or, you know, say something like, oh, you're older, so do you know how to tweet, or, you know, can you use that computer? Those are the kinds of things that really are discriminatory against older workers.
Is that kind of comment something that can justify a lawsuit in the current setting or under this congressional bill? Or does there have to be some kind of harm like a firing, a non-promotion, not being hired, that kind of thing?
You know, we know that abusive words just on their own are enough to create a hostile work environment, but it really has to be more severe and kind of more pervasive than kind of a one-off comment. There are lots of signs that you've been the victim of age discrimination. It can be an ongoing, you know, slew of these kinds of comments. It can be that, you know, supervisors deal differently with younger employees, that the younger folks get all of the opportunities for training or promotions. If older workers are kind of always raising their hand, but they're being passed over, then that's sort of a sign that there's age discrimination in the workplace. We always hear about layoffs that, you know, older workers are sort of the first ones to get laid off. And depending on how a company handles that, if the jobs of older workers, you know, sort of get eliminated, but then younger workers pick up those responsibilities, you know, that might be a little fishy. There are lots of ways that we see this kind of discrimination every day in the workplace.
A stereotypical setting for age discrimination is the you know, the Silicon Valley workplace, where they say, well, we're worried that that older worker won't have the skills that that young worker right out of college, right on top of the cutting edge technology, is going to have. What do you say to that kind of workplace mentality? I think we lost Lisa there for the moment. We'll check in with her. We are talking to Lisa Lamkins from AARP Wisconsin, looking at age discrimination in the workplace, a change in the works in Congress when it comes to federal laws. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen age discrimination in your workplace? Have you been the subject of it yourself? Do you feel like you understand what qualifies as age discrimination? How does the place you work at treat older workers generally? And we hear, we'll talk about this a little bit, more older workers staying in the workforce longer, getting back into the workforce just because of how our demographics are going in this country. Is it important that we tackle these issues head on, given that we're going to see more people staying in the workforce into their 60s, 70s, maybe 80s. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about age discrimination in the workplace and possible changes in federal laws. Lisa Lampkins is with us with AARP Wisconsin, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen age discrimination in your workplace? Have you experienced it yourself? Maybe a comment from a boss, trouble getting a job. How did that affect you? If you are on the HR side of things or a business owner or manager, how do you handle these issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Lisa, just a few moments ago, I brought up the issue of that high-tech workplace, say, that thinks, well, the younger workers are going to have the skills, are going to be on top of the technology in a way that the older workers aren't. What do you say to that attitude?
Well, we know, we think those ageist myths are really dated. We hear that older workers aren't as sharp, they're less productive, they're not digitally savvy, they're difficult and set in their ways. And yet all of the research and all the studies show this isn't true. Older workers have knowledge and experience. They are committed. That's stuff that's not easily replaced, and it's really worthwhile for companies to take a look at the value that older workers bring, and not just older workers, but frankly, a diverse workforce in lots of different ways, including a workforce with different generations, is really good and keeps all businesses with a competitive edge.
Let's bring on our callers now. We've got Mike starting us off in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hello. Thank you. One of the things I see, I guess, in the conversation we're having right now is that it's primarily focused on a worker that is currently employed or was perhaps let go. But even in the application process, when you're applying for a job, I see where these companies get around asking you directly what your age is by asking you on the application, when did you graduate high school? And many of the times these electronic applications, you have to fill in a date. You know, these are mandatory fields. And, you know, if you fall within a range that they don't find acceptable, your application may be rejected. So I'd like to see if AARP is getting involved upfront during the applications and these questions that they ask. Be very much akin to asking, you know, whether or not somebody celebrates Christmas as a workaround to asking them what their religious direction is.
Sure. Mike, thanks for the call. Lisa, at the application stage here.
Yeah, you know, recruitment and hiring is a huge area where younger applicants seem to have priority over older applicants. In fact, we've seen that 76% of older workers see age discrimination as a hurdle to finding a new job. That's huge. So AARP has been doing a lot in terms of trying to help older workers find jobs. We have a job board. We have a program that's called Back to Work 50 Plus. We help older workers do resume retooling. And then even more so, we work with employers. We have an employer's pledge program where we work with companies to try to get them to understand the value of older workers. And then have them sign a pledge that they're committed to fighting age discrimination, and that includes through the recruitment and hiring process. And, you know, we've have more than 1,000 employers across the country that have signed on to this pledge, but of course that is still just a fraction, and much more needs to be done in that area. But I think Mike really identified a key place where we can work harder to help older people get new jobs.
And we've seen, before we go back to our other callers, issues in applications and even job advertisements where, hey, if you do job advertising on social media, you can target a lot of demographic groups, including age. You can only let younger people see your online applications if you want to.
Absolutely. And even those people who see them, if an older person sees them, they're often worded in ways, you know, this is a fast-paced environment. We're looking for fresh-faced, applicants. We're going to recruit people who can, you know, be on the go all the time. And so there's this whole notion of our, basically our youth-oriented culture that's so ingrained in many people, but recruiters have done a magnificent job of making an older person say, gosh, I don't see myself in that. And that is just absolutely another form of age discrimination.
Let's go back to our callers now. Susan is with us in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hi. I'll be brief. I'm going back to work after after a brief time off, and I'm 64 and need to work to offset the cost of my rent. And the first two places that I've gone to were very enthusiastically with being flexible with hours and willing to work weekends and holidays. I don't have any family. The first place I was blatantly discriminated against because of a disability. And the second place, Target, I will say, Target, they have signs all over the place that they're hiring. And this person, this assistant manager that was helping me with an application, actually said to me, well, we're really looking just to hire young people.
Wow. Okay, Susan, thanks for that call. So if somebody's in that situation, Susan is Lisa, and here's a very explicit bit of discrimination there. Do they have recourse? What can they do?
Wow. You know, well, Susan, I'm really sorry you ran up against that. And unfortunately, I think Susan's experience is not necessarily unique, especially when we know that older workers 65 plus are the fastest growing age group in the labor force. We've got a lot of older people who want to go back to work or need to go back to work. You know, I really think when it comes to something like that, it is worthwhile going to the company, whether you're within the company or whether it's in Susan's case, you know, trying to get into the company. I think it is worthwhile looking through their process, going to the human resources department. If you're within a company, maybe going to a higher level manager. But that is very blatant. And I would be surprised if Target itself would actually, you know, tolerate that kind of behavior. But unfortunately, we see it everywhere. And that employee probably didn't even recognize that it was age discrimination. And that was flat out age discrimination in the recruitment process.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lisa Lamkins is with us from AARP Wisconsin. We're talking about job discrimination for seniors, age discrimination at the workplace, and the hiring process, the firing process, promotions, harassment, and beyond. Back to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, Lisa. I don't know if I've heard you mention about the AARP bulletin for January and February of this year. It has the article about, or a special report about ageism in the workplace. And I think it's available through the AARP.org website, even for non-members. I know I could get access to it, but I think it's access ready for people who aren't members also.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Lisa, a plug there for some of your resources at AARP.
And I don't even know Dennis, but Dennis, thank you. I couldn't have paid Dennis to make a better pitch because he's absolutely right. And it really was, I think, just good timing on our part. There's all sorts of stuff percolating around age discrimination, but there is a special report in the AARP bulletin on age discrimination. And, you know, it will actually also outline the issue and it will have some of the resources that AARP is using to fight age discrimination. And anybody can access it at AARP.org. If you just type in, you know, January bulletin or type in age discrimination, it will pop up and you'll be able to read about the issue, as well as, you know, there'll be some places where you can take action, where you can, you know, have people look at your resume, all sorts of good resources there.
Thanks for the call, Dennis. We'll go now to Jim with us in Johnson Creek. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I own a small business, 10 to 12 employees, and of course a large portion of our expenses are healthcare premiums. And so if we're going to level the playing field with age, we should also be leveling the playing field with being able to afford higher premiums for higher risk patients. And it seems as though families and those higher age patients end up incurring a higher healthcare cost. I'll take my answer off there.
Jim, thanks for the call. So maybe a built-in incentive for that small business to consider age if they're worried about higher healthcare premiums, he says, Lisa.
Yeah, we know that's definitely an issue. And, you know, on the healthcare side, AARP actually fought really hard to make sure that older workers wouldn't experience what we call an age tax, which is having to pay like 7, 8, 9 times as much for their health insurance as opposed to younger workers. And so now by law, because of the Affordable Care Act, older workers can only be charged 3 times more than younger workers. That's still significant, particularly for a small business, as Jim mentions. You know, and I think when you have a small group like that, it can really be a challenge. I think it's also, though, sort of worth noting that what those older workers bring to the company can be very worthwhile and be very valuable. You know, they have a lot of experience. They have institutional knowledge often, and that's actually worth something. And, you know, I know businesses struggle with the cost of healthcare, but I don't think that necessarily age discrimination is sort of the right way to get at it. And we should be figuring out some other ways to help businesses with that.
Thanks a lot for that call. We've got a lot more callers, but unfortunately, we're just about out of time, Lisa, and I want to come back to this legislation in Congress. As we said, it passed the U.S. House. What is next? Do you have hopes that it's going to make it the rest of the way?
Well, as we have seen during this session, not a lot of legislation has been moving in the Senate, but because there has been good bipartisan support for this, we really are going to work hard to get this through the Senate. It's called the Protecting Older Workers Against Discrimination Act. In the Senate, it's Senate Bill 485. I would encourage your listeners to call our senators and, you know, encourage them to have this bill brought to the floor in the Senate. And, you know, we'll go from there. We have high hopes. It's really time that we say discrimination is discrimination, whether it's based on age or race or sex or religion, whatever. But it's no longer okay to discriminate against people just because of their age.
Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
But thanks for having me.
That's Lisa Lampkins, Advocacy Director at AARP Wisconsin. She was with us to talk about why age discrimination is a problem for older workers and a bill that passed the U.S. House this week that would make it easier to bring a claim of age discrimination. Coming up Monday on Central Time, a camp program in Wisconsin helps women in prison connect with their kids. We'll get an inside look at Camp Reunite. We'll check out a new list of 100 great books by African-American women from Zora Neale Hurston to N.K. Jemisin. And we'll pay a visit to a museum featuring a state legend with a Wisconsinite who directs the Harry Houdini Museum in New York. That's Monday on Central Time.